Hello, and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. Lots happening. I hope you guys had an amazing and wonderful Thanksgiving. I certainly did. Spent some great quality time with the girlfriend's family and also with friends on Thanksgiving evening. So it was a real good time for us and politics free. I hope this was the same for you guys. Hope you actually had a really good time. There are all kinds of things happening here in critical thinking at large land. I have been putting a lot of thought into the 100th episode that is coming up. And I've been thinking about doing a live episode. In fact, I've been wondering whether I might want to just change the model of this and make them all live. Not because I'm suffering from any lack of questions to answer, but I just thought it might make the show more interesting. But you guys tell me what you think. I would actually very much like to know what your feedback is on this. So leave it in the comments section. Definitely 100th episode. Pretty sure that's what we're going to do. And, you know, seeing how that goes, we'll see, you know, should I do more of that? But again, I'm kind of curious about what you guys have to say about that. If you've had experience with, you know, YouTube creators doing live, you know, shows, and then of course once they're, you know, once it's recorded and it's over, then it gets posted just like a regular show. And we would probably do it on Sunday morning, because that's when this video, the Q&As, tend to get, they get posted on Sundays. So I think that would be the most sensible time for me to do the live episode, right? It would be Sunday morning my time here in Denver, Colorado. Also, exciting, what with the holiday season now on us and Thanksgiving over, now I get to talk about Christmas, because I'm one of those people who hates people who talk about Christmas and advertise for Christmas before Thanksgiving's even over, like seriously. But now that it's over, critical merchandise. So this is, I'm not wearing it this time, but this is also one of the Xenu designs that I did. Xenu is my rock, and that is how I roll. So anyway, thought you guys might want to see that. There are new designs up and will continue to be going up over the holiday season on my critical merchandise site, link below in the description for this video. And also there is a link on my mncriticalthinking.com website to get to the shop. So please use those links. And consider giving some critical thinking, critical merchandise to this holiday season. And there will be discounts and things like that. So let's get on with your questions, because you've got them and I've got some answers. Leo M. Rogers, if, according to Scientology, the state of clear persists into future lives, would the same happen with EOT levels? Has the church, or would the church, ever recognize someone as a past life OT? If I joined and started recalling the Xenu story in an auditing session, what do you think would happen, presumably, if the auditor hasn't reached OT3, they couldn't react to that without admitting they have read the OT materials? Okay, this is very similar to a question I answered earlier about somebody giving the clear cognition in the middle of a session, if that were to happen, right? Yes, Scientology does recognize and look for past life clears and past life OTs. If, you know, OT is above the state of clear. So, you know, certainly if somebody had attained the state of clear in an earlier life and could be recognized for that in this lifetime, then the same would apply for people who are past life OTs. And of course, they're only going to be, if somebody's saying, hey, look, I think I was a past life OT, they're going to be dealt with eventually by somebody who is OT, who's going to know the information, and so know what to expect to hear from that person. If somebody were to come into Scientology and start talking about the Xenu story in an auditing session as though they were recalling it, you know, from earlier auditing that they'd had, in other words, if they sounded legitimately like they were doing this, not just walking in there and goofing around or playing around, but actually in an auditing session, then that would probably be taken fairly seriously. There are a number of security check questions that get done and things like that, looking into that get done in order to verify if a person is legitimately a past life OT. And they would want, you know, your name, for example. They'd go look for any folders that had that person's name. That wouldn't necessarily be a point that, you know, if they couldn't find any folders, if you said, yeah, my name was Joe Jackson, and they couldn't find any folders for Joe Jackson, they wouldn't say, well, you're a liar. But they would do the search for Joe Jackson's folders, is what I'm saying. That's part of the procedure. Hubbard wrote bulletins and instructions for how to deal with somebody who's had auditing in a past life. And almost every Scientology parent thinks that their kid is a returnee. Like, I'll just one for one, they just think that, right? You can even, on my interview with Tim and Sylvia DeWall with Larissa, they even talk about that. They thought for sure she was, you know, somebody who'd come around again. So that sort of thing happens. Now, if the auditor, of course, didn't know anything about OT materials and stuff, and you say, I think I got some OT auditing in the last life. Let's say you're in an auditing session, and you're with somebody who's not OT as the auditor, right? And you go, yeah, I think I was OT, and I think that this is what we covered. The auditor would actually say, actually, hold up. Now, because I'm not OT, I would prefer that you actually not tell me these things right now. But what we're going to do is after session, you are free to write down anything you want to write down as to what you're recalling or what's happening that makes you feel like you've had past life OT auditing. And we'll get that to a properly trained case supervisor who, you know, in your folder, and they'll be able to evaluate your information, right? But I'm not OT, so I can't hear anything about that. So just go ahead and keep that to yourself right now. And that would be the common sense handling that an auditor who's not OT would do with you in the auditing session, because he doesn't want to hear about the Xenu story. Whether he's heard about Xenu on South Park or not, he doesn't want to hear about it, right? Because, you know, that would potentially endanger him, is what he would think. As a Scientologist, he would think that, you know, he was actually in some kind of spiritual or emotional, you know, danger if he's exposed to those OT materials before he's ready for it. So you would get some special treatment, and that information would go to a case supervisor who knew what he was talking about, and that would eventually get all looked at, and then they would determine what to do with you. So all of that is accounted for within the world of Scientology. Sheena Nash. I was curious about what is happening behind the scenes here at the Sacramento Ideal Org. After months of being in the middle of a major construction zone, the Ideal Org is now luckily placed right next to the brand spanking new Golden One Arena, where there is now plenty of opportunity to body route concert goers and sports fans. At the same time, there has been a recent glut of Dianetics billboards in the Sacramento metropolitan area. I seriously cannot turn a corner without seeing one. My question is, was Sacramento Ideal Org staff placed in a constant condition of liability for the inability to keep stats up during construction, and how much trouble will they be in if the stats don't go straight up and vertical now that the arena is open and the billboards are ubiquitous? All right, well, I can't answer for Sacramento Org specifically because I'm not in Sacramento. I haven't had anything to do with Sacramento in a couple of years now, because when I first came out of the C organization, I landed in Sacramento, which is where my mother lived. And I stayed with her and my stepfather while I got my feet on the ground for about a month or so before I hightailed it out to Minnesota. So I did go into the Sacramento Ideal Org at that time, and I was involved with the OT committee there and was trying to be a good Scientologist and get hooked up with my local org and start being a contributing Scientologist. Because that's what I thought, you know, when I first came out of the Sea Org, that's what I thought I was supposed to do. So I met, you know, a bunch of the staff. I'd been to Sacramento, of course, before that when I was in the Sea Org. So some of them knew me, and I was, you know, impressed by the building and all that. The OT committee was this very tiny little group of people who weren't really doing a whole lot of anything. And so I thought I could, you know, contribute in some way. It's not that the staff, while that construction activity was going on and everything, were kept in a constant state of liability or lower conditions, you know, with the ethics conditions in Scientology. In other words, they weren't all kept in trouble all the time just because there wasn't anybody coming in. Because let's face it, that's the state of all the orgs right now, is they are all empty, not doing well, barely selling books, barely making any money, barely getting by, right? That really is the state of things with Scientology in most parts of the world. And since that's the case, and since it has been the case for so many years, I mean, going all the way back to, you know, when I was in management in the 80s and in the 90s and early 2000s, and of course, when I was staff in Santa Barbara, I mean, that place was empty all the time. It was, you know, it was hardly anybody ever there. The most time we ever had anybody in the organization's building was during the Christmas potluck dinner when everybody would come out of the woodwork and bring a casserole or whatever, and we'd have this great big Christmas dinner. That was the busiest time of the year at Santa Barbara Org, and I imagine it's the same in every other org that I've ever been in, because they all are a lot like Santa Barbara was. The things that get people in trouble, staff and stuff in trouble in Scientology, is not that the organization is not doing well. It's when the organization is doing so not well that it becomes a burden on management. And that's when they start getting the ire and stink eye from the Sea Org, is when the Sea Org has to come bail them out to pay their rent or their mortgage payment or somehow keep the building afloat or keep them going, because the staff are not managing to keep it going by themselves. If the org just kind of keeps its doors open and barely squeaks by and barely makes enough to kind of keep going, you know, then Scientology is pretty happy with them, especially now, because, you know, the outer orgs, the local churches, are barely used or paid attention to at all, and are certainly not seen by management as hubs of activity that are going to drive new public in and boom Scientology. I mean, I think that ship sailed years ago as far as management is concerned. They know these orgs are just not going anywhere and they're never going to. They would never admit any of this. Now, keep in mind, I'm talking about what they think in their heads, not what they sit around talking about. What they talk about is, we got to get these orgs going, and we got to like drive in business, and we got to make these guys make it. And these guys who struggle and aren't doing it, well, they're off policy, they're out ethics. I mean, they say these things, right? They talk to between themselves about this sort of thing. But as far as real drive and a real intention to make the orgs successful, that doesn't exist. Management's too busy, you know, jerking itself off for any of that, because they have constant emergencies and constant problems and stuff put on their plate within the C organization. So, and the constant demand for money is the number one problem that's put on their plate all the time, is money for the IAS, money, money, money. So these organizations are only used to be places where the sales guys, the regs, I'm hesitating on using this word, but the regs, the registrars, the Scientology salesmen go, and the IAS, the International Association of Scientology fundraisers, go to make money for the International Association of Scientologists. That's the primary use of these local churches, and it has been for over a decade, maybe about 15 years now. That's been pretty much what the orgs are used for. So that's kind of the situation. So I'm going into all this because you said, well, are the staff going to be in a lot of trouble? You know, or were they in a lot of trouble because the place was empty because of construction? Yeah, no, not really. Not as far as I know. And will they now, you know, drive in a bunch of business now that they can body route and all that? Yeah, probably not. Because Scientology is just toxic in the big wide world. And so I think Scientology's overall is trying to be kind of low key and trying to be, you know, kind of not have controversy right now and not have too many, you know, bad things going on within it, and is trying to chill the hell out. you know, the violence has chilled some, and the, you know, the abortions, the forced abortions don't happen anymore. And all those things that Scientology got into so much trouble for over the last 20, 30 years is now like kind of chilling within the Scientology world so that they can, you know, just kind of keep getting by. And but they're going to carry that bad name for forever, you know, until they start doing something good. And Scientology is what it is. So it's not going to do something good. It's just going to kind of keep trying to keep its head down PR-wise so it can keep raking in as much money as it can from its existing membership. So that's my immediate prediction on all that sort of thing. Tandem Cross. Question. You just died. Scientology is true. What now? As in your thoughts and action reaction. Same question, but you died a believer in the Sea Org. Okay, so let's say that I just, you know, have a heart attack or whatever, die in my sleep, get run over by a truck, and suddenly find myself floating outside my dead body and wondering, whoa, hey, look at this, spiritual existence is true. Oh, wow, I actually am a Thetan, right? Now there would be, there would have to be a lot more that would have to happen in order for me to know that what's going on at that moment is the Scientology version of what goes down, right? In other words, I'd also have to, you know, am I being sucked anywhere by an implant station that wants to make me forget everything that just happened to me, right? Is that, I guess that would have to be part of the picture. And do I have this urge to go get another body and you know, assume a baby body and take it over at the local hospital or find a pregnant woman and, you know, and assume control of the little unborn fetus, right? Like, would I have a compulsion in that direction? Because, you know, according to Scientology, I should have some kind of idea or compulsion or push in that direction. So let's say that, you know, your question is Scientology is true. So now what? So yeah, if all those things were happening, I'd be like, well, damn. Okay. I guess Hubbard got some things right after all. And I guess, you know, maybe, me doubting some of what he had to say about that was wrong. Okay. You know, I mean, I'm willing to change my mind when I'm presented with evidence to the contrary to my thoughts and ideas. I would still stand by everything I've ever said about the corruption of Scientology's organizations and their, you know, insane focus on money over helping people and that sort of thing. Everything I've said about all that is 1,000% true, whether we really are Thetans or not, right? But that would be interesting, you know, and I would strive to try to not forget everything, you know, if I could. According to Hubbard, that's a, you know, pretty tall order, because the mechanisms, the mental mechanisms that are in place in order to keep a person from being able to remember their past lives and that sort of thing, right? You're supposed to forget when you, you know, grab a new baby body and stuff. So I don't know, you know, I would give it a go, you know, maybe I would even try to find, you know, I don't know, maybe I'd even try to, if I really realized that Scientology was actually real, you know, I don't know, I'd have to think about this. Maybe I would even try to go find a Scientology family to, you know, hook up with, right? But I don't know. I don't know how much control I would have over that sort of thing. It's the whole between lives area thing, what goes on between lives is not super well documented in Scientology. And I've even talked to, you know, OTs who have gone all the way to the top who have had serious questions about what goes on and what's going to happen to them when they die, which I thought was pretty interesting because I figured by the time you're OT, you should definitely have it nailed what's what, you know. But not necessarily, right? And there's all kinds of questions and question marks about that period of time. And Hubbard said some things, right, which I've talked about here, but he didn't really break it all down. And this is one of those areas as an example where I've said that while Scientology covers a lot of stuff in all those books, all those lectures, there's tons of things in Scientology that are never clearly answered, even though you know, you have to infer or come up with your own answers for things And this is one of them, this whole area, right? Now, if I were, you also asked if I had died and was still a believer in the Sea Org, and I found out after I died that it was all true. Well, then I would just keep going on the course I was on, which is billion-year contracts. So now I got, you know, a 21-year leave of absence from the Sea Organization to grow a new body and show up again and report for duty. So I would go find a Scientology family somewhere that I could grow up in, so I'd be hooked back up in with Scientology. And then I would carry on with my Sea Org life, right? I mean, the whole thing sounds utterly ridiculous because it is. But in the context of your question, if all of this were true, that's how I would act. So that's what I can say about that. Anna, I have recently had a contact with a Scientologist through personal emails. I opened up and talked with her as if she was my friend. I've received a printed letter per post from a Scientologist who's responsible for recruiting a few days later. He wrote me that he noticed I was in contact with his colleague, so he thought maybe I would like to join Scientology. I wrote her many different reasons why I am not interested in Scientology anymore. I also sent her a link to your blog, and she just replied me, "This link which you sent me just represents a criminal. I can see he has bad intentions. Scientology has saved my life." Does Scientology have the right to check members' personal emails, or can I assume it was harassment? Well, this is an interesting question. I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure from the way you're writing this if the Scientologist you were initially in touch with was a staff member or just a regular public Scientologist. It's very possible that regardless of whether it was a staff member or a public Scientologist, let's say that you were first in touch with somebody named Sally. Okay, so it's very possible that Sally went to her local church organization and told them about you and said, I'm now in touch with somebody who wants to know more about Scientology and I'm not really sure what to do. And so that Sally gave your name and number to the church and then they had somebody in the church start contacting you who knows what they're doing, right? And then you answered back with, you know, a link to my blog. Good! And of course, they responded that I'm a criminal because anyone, according to the church's policies, anyone who talks the way I do about Scientology has to have real world crimes and be a criminal. Otherwise, we wouldn't be criticizing Scientology the way that we are. And this is not hyperbole or exaggeration. They really say and think that anyone who criticizes Scientology the way that I do is a criminal. So they can't afford to let themselves listen to what I say or give any credence to anything that I'm talking about or give me the time of day because I'm just a criminal, right? So that's how Hubbard branded any critic of Scientology and that's the mind control that goes on so that Scientologists will not listen to anything anti-Scientology. Fortunately, most people have a brain and they realize that just can't be true with the number of people who have spoken out about Scientology. We can't all be criminals. And they then, see problems going on with the organization and then they give us a listen and start, seeing that what we're talking about is actually very, very true. Okay, so that's one scenario, and it's probably the most likely one, is that the first person you were talking to referred the organization to you. Scientology staff and the Sea Org do not have access to every Scientologist's personal emails. That would be crazy, and Scientologists wouldn't stand for that. That's just no public Scientologist would be okay with that. If a public Scientologist, let's say, Joe Blow, Scientologist, gets in ethics trouble at his church for something related to emails, like let's say he gets in trouble for talking with somebody like me, a suppressive person, right? In such a case as that, a specific case like that, the church will ask that person, okay, I want to see your emails, right? And the Scientologist would be expected to turn over his password and turn over his email address to the ethics officer so the ethics officer could check his emails out, right? But that would be a specific case of a specific Scientologist who's in trouble because of something like that. As a general rule, Scientologists don't turn over their email accounts to the Church of Scientology. And as a general rule, the Church of Scientology does not intrude into the personal email accounts of their parishioners. So I think that's, I think my explanation is probably the most likely for what happened to you. It's time for flash answers. Matt called. I was wondering why you make a distinction between Catholics and Christians. You're not the only one who seems to separate Catholics and Christians as if they were two different things that have widely different beliefs. I've noticed the talking heads on the TV news do it. Journalists and print media do it as well. Catholics are indeed Christians too. To use a twist on a common phrase, not all Christians are Catholics, but all Catholics are Christians. Just curious is all. Thanks for all you do on this channel and reading my question. Yeah, Matt, I probably picked it up because I read it in print or, you know, news media, Catholics and Christians, and not knowing a whole lot about it when I first got out of Scientology and started doing these videos, I just thought there were enough differences between them that I said Christians different from Catholics. I've come to learn since then, I've learned a lot more about it, that, you know, all Catholics are Christians, that they consider themselves Christians because they believe in Christ. But of course, Catholics do have Catholic rituals and ceremonies and a church hierarchy that is very different from Seventh-day Adventists or Westboro Baptists or, you know, Foursquare Christians or lots of other Christian groups. There's tons and tons of sects of these different Christian groups. And Catholics are a very big group with their own practices and their own ideas. So I think that's why they might get differentiated from your, you know, I don't know, run-of-the-mill Christian versus the guy who's going to church. Yeah, I think Catholics, from my understanding, have also been regarded as people who are even more church-going, more faithful, maybe, you know, maybe more dedicated in certain ways, right? They go to confession and this kind of stuff. And, of course, eating the, you know, the wafers and the and drinking the wine and this kind of thing is something different from what a lot of other Christians do, is from my understanding of it. So I think that's why the differentiation. I wasn't particularly trying to say Catholics aren't Christians. Just I didn't have it fully clear myself. And so when you hear me talking about it, that's probably why. In the future, I probably won't be making such distinctions. Stephen Willis. You write in your book how L. Ron Hubbard left a provision in his will that only a tax-exempt organization could inherit his assets, including his valuable copyrights and trademarks to Scientology materials. So how did Scientology run between LRH's death in 1986 and being granted tax exemption in 1993 when it owned no rights to its own materials? Good question. And I believe the answer, I mean, I wasn't privy to how Scientology was running during that time because I wasn't at INT management. But from what I understand, it ran on tiptoes because they knew that they were in a very, very vulnerable position because they did not have those trademarks. However, nobody knew that. This was not broadly publicized information. No one knew. That information didn't get disseminated or talked about until much later, until after the copyrights were nailed down, you know, with the tax exemption. And so it's not broadly, you know, it was not broadly understood the church's vulnerability during that time period. And I think that RTC, you know, Miscavige and the lawyers and all that were very nervous around that time period. And that was one of the reasons that drove them so hard to get that tax exemption. In addition, of course, to the fact that they had this, you know, $1 billion bill, you know, accrued with the IRS, not really a billion, but it was a lot. It was a lot. And they were really facing a make break. You know, if they didn't handle that IRS situation, it was going to be the end of Scientology, no question. So and that trademark issue was only one of multiple reasons why that was true. So as far as I know, they just tiptoed around it, didn't get involved in a whole lot of court cases during that time over trademarks specifically, or if they did, they were bluffing. And that's how they dealt with it. Barbara Ann, just wondering, with the new president coming in, is anyone outside of the cult doing anything or contemplating any actions to get tax-exempt status taken from Scientology? How much money could the U.S. make up if Scientology were paying their fair share? If they were to be called on the table and made to pony up, would it virtually shut the group down in no time? I'm not aware of any actions being done specifically with Trump coming into office to gear up to try to get Scientology's tax-exempt status taken away. It's not Trump or his administration who's going to do that. It's going to be the IRS who's going to do that. And the IRS is its own thing. Elections come and go, but the IRS is just the IRS. And whoever the commissioner is and whoever the people at the lower echelons of the IRS, they're the ones who decide what cases to prosecute and look into, what churches to look into to revoke tax-exempt status, and that sort of thing. And that relies on political pressure from Washington for sure. And that political pressure doesn't really exist, but I don't think Trump is going to be the one to bring it. And I don't think anybody in his administration is particularly going to bring it because Scientology, as I've talked about before, has, you know, insider connections, and their tax-exempt status is their make-break. And they know it. So they will fight with everything they have to hold on to tax exemption. If that's ever going to get taken down, it's only going to get taken down after the longest, bloodiest fight Scientology ever puts up about anything. So that's another reason why I don't see anybody in Washington particularly invested in carrying out that fight or prosecuting that fight, because no one really gives a shit about Scientology that much, to be honest. I mean, as Scientology watchers and, you know, as somebody who was involved with the organization, you know, we know that they shouldn't have tax-exempt status. They're a criminal organization, no doubt. But they're one of many, right? I think there's lots of religious groups that shouldn't have tax exemption, including mostly those televangelists and a lot of those, you know, horrible, horrible people. And so so I think Scientology should, you know, not have tax-exempt status. I think a lot of these guys shouldn't. But until there's a change in attitude in Washington about this sort of thing, we're not going to see that happen. And right now, as I understand it, there's a lot of very religious right-oriented people going into Washington. Mike Pence is VP, and other people are being put in who have very strong religious convictions. So they're not going to be interested in going after and prosecuting, you know, tax-exempt organizations and getting rid of them, you know, churches. So I don't really see a whole lot changing with this administration. Kath T. Hi, Chris. Guess what? I have suddenly started receiving Freedom Magazine, addressed to me personally at my work address. I am wondering if Scientology trolls got my name because I comment on things like your videos and I post stuff about Scientology sometimes on my Facebook page. In fact, I'm sure of it. What do you think? I'm really not sure what to think. It's too broad of a situation for me to actually be able to say one way or the other if that's the case. It's possible, of course, you know. I don't know how somebody would track down your personal data from YouTube without your full name or without your information. If that information is publicly available on your YouTube address or something, then I suppose they could get that. On your Facebook page, sure, you know. But it would rely a lot on your connections, you know, and how much you're speaking out, how much trouble you're worth, because Scientology doesn't have a lot of resources to invest in harassing people, right? They have some, but they don't have a lot. So they're going to target people that they think are going to make a difference. And so if they feel, for whatever reason, that they, you know, that you're somebody that they need to be targeting, then they'll do it. I can't say, you know, that they're not doing that, but it is rare that they would go after somebody on such a basis. So that's about all I can give right now. I know that's not super satisfactory, but I can't say definitively yes or no on your question. Okay, guys, so that is our show this week. Again, check out the Critical Merchandise. Give me your feedback, your questions, your comments. I want it all down below, including your feedback on the idea of taking this show live, whether it's a one-off for the 100th episode or whether that would be an ongoing thing or a semi-ongoing thing. You guys tell me what you want. I'm very curious about your answers on this one. So Thanks a lot for coming around and watching, and I'll see you guys next week. Bye-bye.